the topic of Agnon and the Holocaust and Holocaust writing and Holocaust literature is a very complicated one, which we will not be able to exhaust, and a very difficult one. It would be impossible in the 45 minutes or so that we have to either really address it properly or to properly read together his signature story, which we'll attempt to do b'miktzat, his signature story called Hasiman, which I have available for you here in the English translation. If you'd like, and of course I heartily recommend it, if you'd like to read it in Ivrit, you can email me and I'll be happy to email it to you, but it's in this volume. I'm sure many of you have Kitvei Agnon at home, Ha'esh Va'etzim, which I'll mention in a few moments. For Agnon, just, it might be, I would hope to this august audience it would be unnecessary, but just a brief biographical sentence. Agnon was born 1887, even though he always insisted he was born on Tisha B'Av 1888, for various biographical reasons, in Buchach, in Galicia, in eastern Galicia, in what today is part of the western Ukraine. He comes on Aliyah as a young man in the first decade of the 20th century. In 1912, he goes to Germany, actually, for what's meant to be a sojourn, a certain amount of time to study and to read. And similar to Rav Kook, World War I breaks out. He gets stuck in Europe, and he can't return. And then he gets married and gets bogged down with family life and has two children, and establishes himself as already then perhaps the premier or among the young premier Hebrew writers in the world. And in 1924, he returns to Yerushalayim and lives here until the end of his life. Of course, he is awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1966, the only Hebrew author, although the Jewish people and the Israeli people have many Nobel Prizes to our credit, as that email that goes around from time to time. I'm sure you get those kinds of emails, the list of all the Jews. You know, we have more than our fair share of Nobel, but it's the only prize we've ever won for literature, is Agnon's, in Hebrew literature. There are other Jews that have won for writing literature in other languages. And he passed away in 1970. The question of writing as a response to suffering is something that he deals with very often. You have one of these? If you have one, you can take it out. I won't ask you for it. You know, they're going to change the money. It's the 50 shekel bill. They're about to change the money. You know, so he'll be taken off after however many. Well, I guess that's fair that they have to rotate them. But here on the money, it's hard to see, but right here, in the previous version of the bill, when the bills used to be held horizontally instead of vertically, I think it was easier to read, but here along the side is the famous quote from the Nobel Prize speech, that because mitoch katastrophe historit shechriv Titus melech Romi et Yerushalayim vagala Yisrael me'artzo nolarati ani Bachat Me'arei Hagula. I trust I don't need to translate. Right? There's a story. Really, I should have been born in Yerushalayim. But my cradle, as it were, got carried off to the exile. And I was born a Galicianer. What can you do? I mean, if you have to be born in Galus, but he's a Galicianer. Those of you that are smiling are probably Galicianers, as am I. And this idea that writing his fiction, writing poetry, or the entire artistic undertaking is somehow a response to catastrophe, to Jewish catastrophe writ large, and personal suffering on the individual level, is something that runs throughout. If you're familiar, as anybody that's familiar with Agnon's writing is probably familiar with his short story Hamit Pachat, the kerchief. It's still today one of the few things that are still on the syllabus. That school children read, even in America, in the few schools that are valiantly holding on to Ivrit, in some way, shape, or form, this is one of the stories that's still studied. Maaseh Ha'ez also, Hamit Pachad, also addresses this idea of the response to suffering, in that case, longing for his father, who's gone off for business and missing him, but as a metaphor for longing for his father in heaven, who's gone off, and we nationally are missing him. So this idea that you can write something which is a response to individual suffering, and that individual suffering is somehow a metaphor for larger national universal suffering, is something that runs throughout his stories. That being said, about, I don't know, 20 years ago, there was an article written by Dan Laor, who's Agnon's main biographer. He wrote, there's only one large biography of Agnon by Professor Dan Laor. I'm told it's actually now being translated into English. And he wrote an article which asked, Ha'im Agnon katav al ha-Shoah? Did Agnon write about the Shoah? Which, believe it or not, is actually a reasonable question. Even though this particular story that we're going to look at notwithstanding, the Shoah does not play a central role in his writing. Now, Agnon wrote a tremendous amount. We have, I think there's 24 volumes of collected writings now. I think it's 24 volumes, 9 of which were published, 23 volumes, 9 of which were published in his lifetime, and another 14 volumes that were published by his daughter from his estate after he passed away. It's a lot of writing. And he had a very long active career. In other words, Agnon is, you know, very often compared to Kafka, which was a comparison which he did not like at all. And he refused to accept it, even though it's so obvious that he read Kafka, and it's so obvious that there were influences. But among the major differences is that Kafka died, he was a young man. Kafka died, I think he was 34 or 35. Agnon lived to be into his 80s, and he had an active writing career of over 60 years. So he has this huge output of material. So when you look at the entire corpus of Agnon's writing, the Holocaust does not play a very dominant front and center role. Certainly not in the way that it does with authors like Elie Wiesel. You know, Elie Wiesel has this quote on this sheet, that I handed out, that there is no such thing as Holocaust literature. There can't be. But of course, like so many things, Wiesel contradicts himself, because he's one of the great proponents of a Holocaust literature. Certainly not like, let's say, the poet Uri Zvi Greenberg, or Primo Levi, or Aaron Appelfeld. Agnon's Holocaust writing is not like those. Not only because he's not a survivor. Agnon was already living here in Palestine during the war, but because his interest as a writer is very different. Among his most well-known works, cited for special praise by the Nobel Committee, is a novel called Oreach Natal Lalun, or in the English translation, A Guest for the Night. I'm curious, has anybody read this novel? It's worth reading. It's a story based upon, like so much of his writing, based upon a biographical kernel. In 1930, after having lived here off and on since 1907, Agnon returned to Berlin for a short period of time, because the first edition of his collected writings was being published, at that time in 4 volumes. And in 1930, the center of Jewish publishing was in Berlin. You couldn't publish a set of books like that here, at least, and not do it well, not the way that Mr. Schocken wanted to have it done. I mean, it's the eve, 1930, it's like almost the eve of the Holocaust, and the center of Jewish publishing and printing is still in Berlin. They didn't have sufficient type. You know, like when the typesetters would set the type of a book, there wasn't sufficient type here in Yerushalayim to print a set of four books with the quality that the publisher wanted. So he had to go back to Berlin to supervise this publishing, but he was an inveterate reviser, Agnon was. And as they're printing the books, he's doing revisions, which is driving the publisher mad. And it took a while, and the books were published, but while he was in Europe, he made his way back via Galicia, via Buchach. And he goes to make this return visit home. You can never go home again, to his hometown, which plays such a prominent role in his writing. At that point, his parents had already died natural deaths, and his siblings, I think, had already moved away from Buchach, some here and some had gone to Germany. He writes a story about a guest, the guest for the night, who he's never named, but he obviously shares very many biographical similarities to Agnon the man. And instead of it being a short visit, it's a visit that takes place over the course of a year, through the cycle of the Chagim, from Yom Kippur to Yom Kippur. And it's a portrait of Eastern European society crumbling. Eastern European Jewish society crumbling, both from without as well as from within. Crumbling gashmius, financially, materially, but more so spiritually and emotionally. It reminds us of the catastrophic impact that World War I had on Europe and on European Jewry, which is something that we overlook today from the perspective of the Holocaust standing between World War I and us, because you can't compare. Everything is overshadowed. Everything is eclipsed by the Holocaust. But it reminds us of how devastating World War I was to Eastern European society, to European society in general, and to Jewish society as well. You read the novel. Again, the novel is set in 1930. You read the novel today, and you would be certain that it was probably written in the 50s, and he's writing backwards, projecting the events of the Holocaust. But it wasn't. The novel itself was published in September 1939, at the very, very outbreak of World War II, and it had been completed already more than a year before. So knowing that, it's clairvoyant in its foreshadowing of events that the author didn't know about as he was writing them. In fact, in June of 1943, the last Jews of the Buchach ghetto of his town were rounded up and mass executed in the cemetery in Buchach. There was a nearby labor camp that was also liquidated. Liquidated is a kind of euphemism, but we know what it means. And then there was a roundup of the other Jews that were hiding out in the surrounding woods, so that when the Red Army captured that area in a year later, in July of 1944, there were less than 100 survivors of Buchach left in the area. The news reaches Agnon in June of 1943 that Buchach has been destroyed. On Erev Shavuos. Shavuos is coming up, a little less than five weeks from now. And he writes a story about it. The first iteration of the story is published in the 40s, in 1944, one page. The kernel of the story is there. And then over the years, he reworks it. So that when this volume, Ha'esh Va'etzim, which was the last collected volume that was published in his lifetime, is published in 1962, the story has morphed into a 30, 40-page short story that we have in front of us. And it's collected in this volume called Ha'esh Va'etzim. The title should, of course, resonate with you. V'akeda, right? Hinei Ha'esh Va'etzim, Ha'eh Ha'sela La'ola, says Yitzchak. And everybody working in literary criticism in Hebrew literature and in Jewish literature in general points out that the Akedah becomes an in Avtipus. It becomes a trope. It becomes a model, a literary model that we point to in talking about the Holocaust. So that Kurzweil, Baruch Kurzweil, for the pioneer of Agnon criticism, you know, says about this volume that this theme, that everything has been turned to Esh ve'etzim, that we, the Jewish people, became the Esh and the Etzim, the fire and the wood, in the absence of a sacrifice to replace us, is a theme that runs throughout much of the volume. The story itself, I mean, let's look at the story. We don't have time to read it all, obviously. It's a story, it's an inauguration story. You know, like we have in Sifrei Nevuah, Lahavdil, the initiation of the Navi to his task. It's a story of how Agnon becomes a chronicler of the Holocaust. And if you understand the story, you can understand, therefore, how what he's doing, what he's writing, even things that he was writing before the Holocaust, become a type of Holocaust literature. But again, a very different type, a very different genre of Holocaust literature than those authors I mentioned. So here on page 397, in the year, this is 1943, when the news reached us that all the Jews in my town had been killed, I was living in a certain section in Jerusalem, in Talpiot, in Arnona. This is the house. Anybody been to the Beit Agnon? It's worth visiting. On Rehov Klausner in Talpiot. In a house I built for myself after the disturbances of 1929, Tarpat, the Arab riots in 1929, Agnon had been living out there in Talpiot. Again, in this period, Talpiot is far away. It's not even part of the municipal boundaries of the city of Jerusalem, technically. That's why if you go to the Beit Agnon, you can see, there's a picture of it here on the, Agnon's house is covered in this kind of, I think it's called stucco. It doesn't have Jerusalem stone. And every building in this town, it's not even Jewish. It's from the mandatory period. But somebody had this idea. It would be nice if the entire city was built in this limestone, in the Jerusalem stone that I'm sure every one of us lives in a building or lives in a house made of Jerusalem stone. Agnon's house isn't that way, because when it was built in the 30s, it wasn't part of the municipal boundaries. It had its own, it was able to be built this way. So on the night when the Arabs destroyed my home in 1929, I vowed that if God would save me from the hands of the enemy and I should live, I would build a house in this particular neighborhood which the Arabs had tried to destroy. By the grace of God, I was saved from the hands of our despoilers, and my wife and children and I remained alive in Jerusalem. Thus I fulfilled my vow and built a house and made a garden. Now this idea of the garden, if you go to the house today, there's a very lovely garden in the back with the trees and things. You can see this other picture of him and his young daughter. They describe that it was just like a rocky hill. It's mamash al sfat hamidbar. Agnon describes from one window, from the eastern window, you were able to see all the way down to the Dead Sea, which you can't do anymore because other buildings have been built to block the view. And if you look to the north, we're able to see all the way to Har HaBayit, or at least to the old city. And it's a rocky, desolate, windy area, and a rocky backyard. And the kids would be paid, you know, whatever it was, a chatzi grush, to go and collect a pail of rocks from the Gina, so they could turn the soil over and plant things there. And this idea of reclaiming the land becomes a theme that runs throughout the story. And that's the first thing that should set off a light for us. What kind of Holocaust literature is written in and about Talpiot? Holocaust literature, we think Warsaw Ghetto, we think Lodz, we think Auschwitz, we think Birkenau. But this is a story written about the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, written in and about Talpiot. And that's the first thing that should set off a bell that says this is different than other Holocaust literature we know about. And this idea of working the land and claiming the garden, planting the flowers and etc. is an idea which runs throughout the story. And really one of the themes of the story is this setting up this oppositional relationship between life in Chutz La'aretz, life in the Gola, and life here in our own land. Even when it's difficult here in our own land. He's writing, he says, this is a land where the Arabs come and they destroy our houses. Right? 1929, his house is ransacked, his writings are destroyed, his library is destroyed. If you go, one of the very impressive things about Beit Agnon today is his very impressive library, his very impressive Sifriya, if you've seen it. That's his third library. I mean, Agnon was one of these children. It's very interesting. And not to overemphasize the point, there are a lot of parallels with Rabbi Soloveitchik's biography. He's a young boy. He goes off to Cheder, because that's what little Jewish kids do. He goes to Cheder for a year or two. The Rebbe tells his father, I have nothing left to teach him. He sits from that day on and learns one-on-one with his father. His father was a Rav, and apparently a very impressive Lamdin, but he worked for a living in the fur trade. And he would, while his father was at work in the morning, he would go to the Beis Medrash in Buchach, and he would just sit and read. And he read everything, and he had one of those kinds of memories, and he, you know, just absorbed everything. And then he would sit and learn with his father. And he kept up a regimen of learning throughout his life. But the library that he has now is his third collection. His first collection of books was destroyed in 1924 in a fire that destroyed his home when he was living in Germany. At that point, he says, we're going back. We're coming back to Yerushalayim. Then in 1929, his library is largely destroyed when his house is ransacked in the riot. So the library he has now is the third iteration of that library. And he builds this house and he reclaims the land. With every sorrow, I used to say how much better it was to live in the land of Israel than outside the land. For the land of Israel has given us strength to stand up for our lives. While outside the land, we went to meet the enemy like sheep to the slaughter. Tens of thousands of Israel, none of whom the enemy was worthy even to touch, were killed and strangled and drowned and buried alive. Nergu, v'nechneku, v'nishchatu, v'nisrafu. Among them, my brothers and friends and family who went through all kinds of great suffering in their lives and in their death. By the wickedness of our blasphemers and our desecrators of filthy people, blasphemers of God, whose wickedness had not yet matched since man was put upon the earth. I made no lament for my city, chapter 2, and did not call for tears or for mourning over the congregation of God, whom the enemy had wiped out. The day when we heard the news of the city and its dead was Erev Shavuot. So I put aside my mourning for the dead because of the joy of the season when our Torah was given. It seemed to me that the two things came together, that the news of what happened, and it being Erev Shavuot, to show me that in God's love for his people, he still gives us some of that same power which he gave us as we stood before Sinai and received the Torah and commandments. It was that power which stood up within me so that I could pass off my sorrow over the dead of my city for the happiness of the holiday of Shavuot, when the Torah was given to us, and not to our blasphemers and desecrators, who kill us because of it, because of the Torah. And here are the other two big themes that run throughout the story. I'll do them backwards. The third one is, this idea of the Torah as the source of our life, but also the source of what causes the blasphemers to hate us, to try to destroy us, to persecute us. The first theme being this, the opposition between life here and life there. The second one, the Torah as source of life, but also not. And he's not saying this in a blasphemous way, but as the source, the Torah, I guess, is a stand-in for our relationship with God, as a source of what has everybody out to persecute us. And the second theme that he laid out is this conflict between Avel v'Yom Tov, between joy and sorrow. And this is probably something we've all, Rahman al-Atslan, I'm sure everyone of us has encountered this either ourselves or certainly those that were active in Rabbonos. I just had it in our community in Efrat on Erev Pesach. Guy gets the call, his father passed away 2 days before Yontif. You know, you bury the body, you have a minute of Shiva, a couple minutes of Shiva, Yontif comes, and you're done. And you're done. My father-in-law, Zichron Levracha, passed away 2 years ago, a couple days before Leila Seder. We had the funeral, we had a couple days of an abbreviated Shiva, and then you have to go, like a turning on a dime. You have to sit at the Seder table with the whole family, with the children that themselves are Avelim, and the widow and the grandchildren and the sons-in-law and the, right? I'm sure every one of us has encountered this in one way or another, and it's always very stark. And it's always very this conflict between emotions that we can at least aspire. The halakha demands us to at least aspire to do a triage of our emotions. Is a very emotionally packed, charged item. And he's describing, he says, I get the news that my whole town is destroyed. But it's Yontif, so I have to table that. And that is a theme that again runs throughout the story, because it's not so easy to do. And if you'll take the time to read the story, you'll see that it's a tale of, you know, like trying to make a bed with a sheet that's a little too short. You know, you can get it over three corners, and then you pull it, you try to like get everything under control, and you try to get it over that fourth corner, and it pops up over there. And there's no way to completely contain the item, contain the sorrow. And you know, you're trying to do what you have to do on Yom Tov. You try to go to Tikkun Leil Shavuot, you try to go to Shul and Davin, and do all the Yom Tov things, and it keeps popping up, and you keep having to whack it aside, right? Because you don't want to think about that. You don't want to feel those emotions right now, because they can't coincide with Simchat Yom Tov. Here on the top of page 400, this is he goes to Shul on Leil Shavuos. The neighborhood was quietly at rest. No one stopped me on the street. No one asked me for news of the world. Even if they had asked, I wouldn't. I'm sorry. Quite troublesome if a glass of water. Even if they had asked, I wouldn't have told them what happened to my city. The days have come when every man keeps his sorrows to himself. What would it help if I told someone else what happened to my city? His city, surely, had also suffered the same fate. So there's an admission here that he's telling the tale of Buchach. And all of his writing is really the tale of Buchach, or the tale of Galicia. But it's this movement between the personalization of the Holocaust in his city as a symbol for the whole thing. He says, I can't describe to you the entire Holocaust, but I can tell you about my city. And that can serve as a symbol.
Thank you very much.
That can serve as a symbol for the larger story. Here on the bottom of page 400, the people who come to the house of prayer begin to gather. Even those whom one usually doesn't see in the synagogue come to bring their children. As long as a child is a child, he's drawn after his father and draws his father with him. That is, he's drawn after his father in heaven and draws with him the father who gave him his birth. In my town, all the synagogues used to be filled with babes like these. They were good and sweet and healthy. Now they're all dead. The hand of the enemy has finished them all. There's no remnant. No one left. So you see, he goes to shul, he sees little kids, and the associative nature of memory, he starts thinking of little kids he used to go to shul 20 and 30 and 40 years ago when he was a kid. They're all dead. Everything here becomes a mirror for what once was. And even though here life in Eretz Yisrael is different, qualitatively, quantitatively, spiritually, emotionally, what have you, But everything here is a reflection of something that was there, and what's there has been wiped out. He comes home, on page 402, he comes home, afterward I said Kiddush, and the blessing, Shechianu v'kiyamanu v'hiyanu l'zman hazeh. Can you imagine, an hour earlier you find out everyone you knew, and you, the whole world that you knew, has been wiped out. And now you have to hold the coast and bend Shechianu v'kiyamanu v'hiyanu l'zman hazeh. I took a sip of wine and passed the glass to my wife and children. I didn't even dilute the wine with tears. It says a lot for a man. His city is wiped out of the world, and he doesn't even dilute his drink with tears. What does that statement mean? Is that Shevach or Gnai? What do you think? He doesn't even dilute his coast with tears. And I think in the context here, it's Shevach. He's saying, I'm trying very hard. I'm not completely... he's already tripped up at least once, and we'll see, he keeps tripping as he goes along, but I'm at least struggling to do what I have to use the halakha as a channel to contain my emotional life. Skip ahead to chapter 12, page 405. Now, children, listen to me. He's telling, they're sitting over the Yontif meal. He's telling his children what Shavuot was like. Now, he's not telling them that Butech has been destroyed, because he's not talking about that. But he's saying, he's recalling, he's reminiscing about his youth. It's like an alcoholic who's on the wagon. He's on the wagon. He's not taking a drink. But he wants to. He's got that thirst. So what's he going to do to get his mind off of drinking? He's going to go sit in the bar. Right? So Adam's saying, I can't be mournful for my city. So what am I going to do? I'm only going to think about my city. So he gets kind of caught in this loop. And he's talking to his children. Now, interestingly, his children, biographically, his children at this time in June of 1943 were 20 and 21 years old. But in the story, there's the Agnon, the writer, and then there's the narrator, who, you know, obviously is meant to be a parallel, a stand-in for Agnon, the biographical man, but there's certain changes. In the story, he presents his children as being little children, when in fact, biographically, they were already young adults, they were already 20 and 21. Now, this could be, you know, one of the authorial sleight of hand. It makes for a more gripping story for us to imagine a man sitting there at the table with a 6 and 7 year old, or a 10 and 12 year old, instead of a 20 and a 21 year old. Or it might also be a type of like a psychological regression, that as he's remembering the story, you know, we do this all the time. Memory's a funny thing. You know, you remember things, and you know, you remember an interaction, imagine with your own children, you don't always get it right. Sometimes you imagine the interaction, they were this tall, when really they were that tall, or maybe it was vice versa. And he's remembering it, he's writing a story in the early 60s about something that happened in 1943, and not common, obviously he knew how old they were when, but when you're portraying it, when you call it up in your mind, sometimes it looks different, and that's how it spills out intentionally onto the page. Now, children, listen to me. I'll tell you something of my youth. Now, your father is old. It's also not yet. At the time this happens, he's 56 years old. Is that old? It depends on how old. And if he let his beard grow, as did Abraham, you'd see white hair in his beard. But I, too, was once a little boy who used to do the things children do. While the old man sat in the house of study in the Beis Medrash, preparing themselves for the time of the giving of the Torah the following morning, during Tikkun Leil Shavuot, my friends and I would stand outside looking upward, hoping to catch the moment when the sky splits open, when the heavens split open, and everything you ask for, even supernatural things, is immediately given you by God, if you are worthy and you catch the right moment. in Hebrew, Hashamayim Nivka'im, the heavens split open. Now this idea, you know, little kids usually get sent off to bed, but one night a year they get to stay up late. They get to stay up for Tikkun Leil Shavuos. Right? And they had this idea that at a certain mystical moment, you could go outside, the time when you're usually tucked into bed and your mother doesn't let you out, you could look up and you can see the heavens splitting open, and it's a moment of grace, and you can ask for anything. Now this moment is going to come back later in the story. Because I had so many things to ask for that before I decided what to wish for, first, what happened? Sleep came upon me and I dozed off. When a man is young, he wishes many things. Before he gets around to asking for anything, he's overcome by sleep. When a man is old, he has no desires. If he asks for anything, he asks for a little sleep. Chapter 14, page 407. After benching, I said to my wife, you go to sleep and I'll go to shul for Tikkun Leil Shavuot. Now, the shul, I mean, I'm going to skip this. The shul is what's called today. Does anybody here live over in Arnona? No? Where do you daven? No, so that's not the shul. But the shul that they today call the Shai Agnon shul is a later shul. Is a later shul where he didn't daven all that often. But they called it when he got very old, he would daven there because it was closest to the house. But there was, in those days, you know, like everybody I live in Efrat, so when we moved into our neighborhood, there was no shul. It took us a lot of years until we built the shul. So we had a caravan that leaked and was cold in the winter and was hot in the summer, and that was the shul. So the same thing in Talpiot. When the Jews moved out to Talpiot, there was what they called the tzrif. There was a tzrif, where today there's a very nice shul called Beit Knesset Achusha. If you ever, there's a park right off of Rehov Kore HaDorot. It's a Sephardi shul. Right off of Rehov Kore HaDorot, there's a very nice park, which used to be called, it's called the HaChursha, because there must have been a Chursha there once upon a time, a wood, a forest. And there was a tzrif, a little shack that they used as the neighborhood shul until they built the proper shuls, which is the way we still do it today in Israel. And that's also the story of how they build the neighborhood and how they build the shul and what it was like. He tells this very evocative story of him. He says, in those days, if they wanted to gather everyone in the neighborhood together for some reason, there were no telephones. So they'd go up to the roof and somebody would blow shofar. And that would call everyone together. But it's also obviously meant to be one of the many markers in the story of the reclaiming the land and building the city as part of the Tahlich HaGeula, of the redemptive process. So he goes to shul and he says, you have to end at 4 or I get the extra time that I... Okay. I'll summarize. He says, a lot of people go to shul, they do the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. He says, but in Butchach, we used to read the Azharot, the Piyutim of Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gabirol. Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gabirol, there you have his picture. I mean, you have a picture of his statue, which stands today in Spain, the great 11th century Paitan. Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gabirol wrote these things called Azharot. It's a type of piyut, a very long piyut, which is a restatement of Taryag Mitzvot in poetic form. And there was a minhag, maybe there still is a minhag in many places. I mean, we have these Azharot, you can find them, you can even find them online. These long piyutim, which are summaries of the 613 Mitzvot. And he says, there was such a minhag. He says, that was my minhag, and I still do this today. I read the poetry of Shlomo ibn Gabirol. And then he goes off on this description of who Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gabirol was, and why he loved him so much, and why he's the greatest of the Paitanim. And he describes this other piyut, which is a geula. He says that, you know, he says in Butchach, you'd go to shul, on Yontif, and they'd say the piyutim, the maraviot, and maybe in some of your shul, did anybody come from a shul where they said the Yontif, the extra piyutim and the maraviot? And here in Eretz Yisrael, we don't say them. When I was a kid, I grew up, this is my great RCA connection, I grew up and was profoundly influenced by the late and lamented Rabbi Stephen Dworkin. I grew up in his shul. Rabbi Dworkin was formerly the executive director of the RCA from Linden, New Jersey. But I also lived between his shul and the JEC in Elizabeth. And sometimes I would walk to the JEC in Elizabeth. I was at a certain point the NCSY advisor there. And in the JEC, they still, I'm sure they still do, say the maraviot, the piyutim that you add in on Yontif, on Leil Yontif, into the Birkat Kriyat Shema. So Agnon says, people used to say the maraviot, they used to say the piyutim. And he says, even though in Eretz Yisrael we don't do it, I still have a lot of affection. I have a lot of affection for that. And one of the piyutim they used to say in Buchach was a ge'ulah, which is a piyut that you would add in, it's meant to be added in to the Bracha of Gaal Yisrael. He describes that they would do it during Musaf because lo na'im to be mafsik ben gula l'tfilah. And it's this piyut which, I mean, you have this picture on Rehov Ibn Gabirol over here in town. Right? So you have this plaque that somebody made on Rehov Ibn Gabirol of this particular piyut, the text of which you have on the next page of Shviya Aniya, of a poor captive girl who's taken off to a foreign land. And Agnon describes as a child he thinks it's about an actual little girl. In other words, he gets only the mushel. He doesn't realize it's a nimshel for the entire Jewish people. Or maybe to the Shekhinah, which has been taken off. If you read the whole story, you'll understand the significance of these two particular piyutim. And really, you can't understand the story unless you learn the two piyutim a little more carefully. But here, you have on page 407, the bottom of 407, there have arisen many poets in Israel who have graced the order of prayer with their poems and strengthened the hearts of Israel with the piyutim, serving as good intermediaries, as shlichei tzibur, between the hearts of Israel and their Father in heaven. And even I, when I humbly come to plead for my soul before my rock and creator, find expression in the words of our holy poets, especially in the poems of Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Gabirol. So this idea that the paitan, or the shaliach tzibur, is meant to give voice to the suffering of the Jewish people, and that by extension, that's also, in Agdam we have this idea of kind of the unity of the artistic enterprise. That all art, Agnon writes very often about art and artists. Sometimes it's a paitan, sometimes it's a novelist, sometimes it's a carpenter that makes an Aron Kodesh, which is the first great Agnon story, Agunot, the story from which he takes his name, Agnon. It talks about an artist fashioning an Aron Kodesh. Sometimes it's a house painter, a la Yitzhak Kumer, the hero of his greatest novel, T'mol Shel Shom. But that somehow these are all stand-ins for each other. That the artistic enterprise is meant to be a response to something, and often it's this response to suffering, to give voice to the pain, and thereby find relief. The story goes on. And again, really, I beg you to read it on your own. If you want, again, my email is at the top of this other page. If you want it in Hebrew, I'm happy to send it to you. And then there are three things that happen as the effort to fight out the memory, to fight out the idea of the sorrow becomes an ever-losing battle. Skip back to page 419. I stood facing the candle. He's there in shul during the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. There are a lot of Yahrzeit candles around. People light Yahrzeit candles, Yontif. My eyes shone like them, except that those candles were surrounded with flowers, and my eyes had thorns upon them. I closed my eyes so that I would not see the deaths of my brothers, the people of my town. It pains me to see my town and its slain, how they're tortured in the hand of their tormentors, the cruel and harsh deaths they suffer. And I closed my eyes for yet another reason. When I close my eyes, I become, as it were, master of the world, and I see only that which I desire to see. So I closed my eyes, and I asked my city to rise before me, with all its inhabitants and with all its houses of prayer. It's a kind of like, what do they call it, guided imagination? Right, Dimyon Mudrach, it's like an imaginative exercise. He says, well, I can close my eyes. He says, in this world, I see the candles. And that's the candle, the Yahrzeit candle is going to remind me of all the dead people. So what am I? I'm going to close my eyes. And when I close my eyes, I can imagine whatever I want. So what's he going to imagine? He imagines his city. He imagines being back there. I put every man in his place where he used to sit and where he studied, along with his sons, sons-in-law, grandsons. For in my town, everyone came to daven. The only difference was in the places. Some fixed their places for prayer in the old house of study, and some in the synagogue, and some in the house, some in the Bate Midrash. And every man had his fixed place. So in other words, he does this experiment in imagination to try to forget about it, but it comes back. Once I arranged all the people in their house, in the house of study, I'm sure everybody does this, you know, like when you, it's like instead of counting sheep, you know, there are probably places in your memory, the home you grew up in as a child. I can do this. I have very strong visual memories of my kindergarten, you know, where I could draw for you a map of exactly how the room looked, how it was set up, where I sat, where the teacher's desk was. If I could be transported back in time, would it be identical? I don't know, but I think it is. In other words, your memory convinces you that that's the way it was. Whether or not, historically or not, is unimportant. I didn't skip a single holy place in her town or a single man. I did this not by the power of memory, but by the power of the synagogues and the houses of study themselves. For once the synagogues and houses of study stood before me, all the worshippers also came and stood before me. The places of prayer brought life to the people in my city, in their deaths as in their lives. I too stood in the midst of the city, among my people, as though the time of the resurrection of the dead had arrived. So in other words, the imagination is not just to, so he can lick the wound, he can pour salt in the wound, but it's also a type of salvation. Because when he thinks of the people, he imagines that they're here, even though he knows they're not. That's a zecher of tchiyat hametim, that there's still hope. There's this passage from Rabbi Nachman. I tracked down the source in Rabbi Nachman that he's alluding to. It's on the sheet. You can do that work yourself. The second attempt is not imagination, but a kind of memory. And he remembers the first time he heard this piyut, Shviya Aniya, O poor lost captive girl, who's dragged away, the piyut of Rabbi Shlomo ben Gavirol. He remembers the chazin, the old chazin in Buchach, who sang the song, who brought the niggun back with him, for he himself had been sent off to Siberia, and when he was redeemed, Pidyon Shvuyim, or he got out and he comes back, he brings with him the niggun of Shvi Aniya, and all of Agnon's associations with this piyut are hooked up with that experience. Because can you imagine, it's not Stam a chazin singing a song. It's a chazin singing a song about captivity with a niggun that he discovered in his own captivity. And it's all tied up together. The third attempt, or the third episode of memory here in chapter 32, is a dream or a nightmare. You know, it happens, you know, ladies, don't tell your friends. I mean, it could be, I mean, maybe you come to shul and stay up all night on Shavuos. Does that ever happen?
Not
too often. But the gentlemen know that it's been known to happen, not by any of the august Rabbonim themselves, that on El Shavuos, sometimes somebody falls asleep, takes a little Dremel. So this is what happens to them. Sometimes on El Shavuos, somebody takes a little Dremel in the middle. Between the cheesecake. It's been known to happen. Never in your shul. Certainly never while any of you were giving the shiur on their shuls. But this happens to Agnon. This happens to Agnon, and he falls asleep and he starts to have a dream. In the dream, he goes back to Buchach. The bottom page 422. I found Chaim the Shamish standing on the bima and rolling the Sefer Torah, for it was Erev Rosh Chodesh. And he was rolling the Sefer Torah to find the Kriya. Below him, in the alcove near the window, is Shalom the Shoemaker. Shalom the Shoemaker. His pipe in his mouth, reading the Shevet Yehuda, exactly as he did when I was a child. He used to sit there reading the Shevet Yehuda, pipe in mouth, puffing away like one who's breathing smoke. The pipe was burnt out and empty, and there wasn't a leaf of tobacco in it, but they said that just as long as he held it in his mouth, it tasted as though he was smoking. I said to him, I hear that you now fast on the eve of the new moon, on Erev Rosh Chodesh. something that they didn't used to do in his town before he, Agdon, left an aliyah. What? Yom Kippur Katan. Chaim said to Shalom, answer him. Shalom took his pipe out of his mouth and said, so it is. Formerly we would pray but not fast. Now we fast but we don't pray. Why? Because we don't have a minyan. I said to Chaim, Shalom, you say there's not a minyan left for prayer. Does this mean that those who used to pray are not left, or that those who are left don't pray? In either case, why haven't I seen a living soul in the whole town? Now again, this is all the conversation taking place in a dream. They both answered me together and said, that was the first destruction. And this is the last destruction. What's the first and last destruction? I mean, it's obviously meant to resonate with us, Bayit Rishon and Bayit Sheni, but it's World War I and World War II. After the first destruction, a few Jews were left. After the last destruction, not a man of Israel remained. I said to them, right, in other words, after World War I, they didn't have a minyan because people didn't come to shul. That's one of the large ideas that runs throughout Oreach Natal Alun, the guests' attempt to resurrect activity in the shul, or in the Beit Midrash, because religious society was deteriorating already. After World War II, there's no minyan because you don't have 10 people living left. I said to them, permit me to ask you one more thing. You say that in the last destruction not a man from Israel was left in the whole city. So how are you here? How are you still alive? Chaim smiled at me the way the dead smile when they see that you think they're alive. I picked myself up and went elsewhere. So this is the third iteration, and it's a dream. Then he wakes up. Give me 3 more minutes. And at the moment when the heavens are meant to open, he has a vision. And the vision, the apparition, is none other than Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Gabirol himself. Now, a lot's been written on this story, particularly from a mystical Kabbalistic perspective. There's a certain roved of Kabbalistic reference here. But I don't think that's what's going on in the story. This is, again, I don't think this actually biographically, I don't think this actually happened. But in the within the context of the story, it's presented in exceedingly realistic detail. End of chapter 35. He didn't speak to me by word of mouth, but his thought was engraved into mine. His holy thought into mine. What is that? No? What's that a description of? Nivuah. I mean, I don't think that's what Agnon is saying. I mean, he's not saying that he received Nevuah from Shlomo ben Gabirol, but it's a description of a type of communication. Every word he said was carved into the forms of letters, and the letters joined together into words, and the words formed what he had to say. These are the things as I remember them word for word. And he describes to Ibn Gabirol that his city has been destroyed. And Ibn Gabirol says, I'll make a siman. That's the name of the story, Hasiman. And the Siman is a piyut in 7 stanzas, acrostic, in the way that those medieval paitanim would do, for Buchach. Go to the last page. The end of chapter 40. Once more he moved his lips. I turned my ear and heard him recite a poem, each line of which began with one of the letters of my name and my town, so I knew that the sign the poet made for my town was in beautiful and rhymed verse in the Holy Tongue. He'd already confessed his anguish that he, the narrator, is not worthy to be the composer of a siman for his town. The hairs of my flesh stood on end and my heart melted as I left my own being and it was as though I was not. Were it not for remembering the poem, I would have been like all my townsfolk who were lost, who had died at the hands of the despicable people, those who trampled my people until they were no longer a nation. But it was because of the power of the poem, and my soul went out of me. And if my town has been wiped out of the world, it remains alive in the poem that the poet wrote as a sign for my city. And if I don't remember the words of the poem, for my soul left me because of its greatness, the poem sings itself in the heavens above, among the poems of the holy poets the beloved of Israel. Now to whom shall I turn? Who can I tell? Who can tell me the words of the song? To the old cantor who knew all the hymns and the holy poets? Well, he's dead. I am all that is left of all their tears. In the Hebrew, it's Hareini Kaparat Dimatchem. Dimatam. Hareini Kaparat Mishkavam. Hareini Kaparat Dimatam. I am the replacement for their tears. The old cantor rests in the shadow of the holy poets who recite their hymns in the great synagogue of a city. And if he answers me, his voice will be as pleasant as it was when our city was yet alive, and all of its people were also still in life. But here, there is only a song of mourning, lamentation, and wailing for the city and its dead. So that, interestingly, he doesn't give us the poem. Like you would think that, you know, you turn the next page, and he would give you the text of the poem that Shlomo Ibn Gabriel wrote, which of course Agnon, the author, himself would have written. But he doesn't do that. And it's similar to the ending of the opening story in the volume, which you should also read, called Lefi Haschar Hatzar, which is actually about a medieval Paitan writing during the Crusades and his struggle to write an Akedah. In Akedah, remember the Akedah? And Akedah is a type of piyut which is inserted for Rosh Hashanah to be read in conjunction with the reading of Akedat Yitzchak, like the Slichot, some of what we call generically the Slichot in Elul. Some of them are, the form of the Slicha is called an Akedah, because it deals with the theme of Akedat Yitzchak. And he's trying to write this Akedah, and he's not sure he gets it right, and the question of is it or is it not accepted in heaven, and if it's accepted in heaven, it doesn't matter if we have it down here, if we remember the Nusach down here, because it's being sung up in heaven for whomever it needs to be sung for. The story itself is a tale of, this story, Hasiman, is a tale of some kind of very deep inner experience that the author is reconstructing or constructing for us. It's not a magical story. It's not a supernatural story. It's interestingly, Agnon had written another volume which wasn't published in his lifetime called Ir Umloa. It's his fattest book. It's in this edition, 740-something pages. It's a chronicle of Buchach. Some of it reads like a medieval Pinkas, you know, like the way they would chronicle the events in the town. And some of it are, you know, stories made up from whole cloth that take place in Buchach. And it's meant to be the chronicle starting in the 17th century, starting with Gzerot Tachvetat, up until the beginning of the 20th century. Some of the stories are 50 pages long, some of them are one page long, everything in between. When his daughter was arranging it for publication, she added, word for word, Hasiman as the afterword to the book. And if you understand this volume and all of his writing, all of his attempt to try to capture life that once was, you understand in what way it's a Holocaust literature different than the way we generally think of Holocaust literature. It's a type of imaginative chronicle. And the story is placed here. Some have argued maybe it would have been better to place it at the beginning, because it's really the story of his induction to being the chronicler of his lost town, and then by extension, all of the six million. It's not a type of lamentation. It's not a type of martyrology where you tell the story of people going, how they went to their deaths. And there is some very, very powerful literature that does it. But it's a kind of a recreation of a lost world. So in the question, did Agnon write about the Holocaust? The answer is yes. And he even started writing about the Holocaust before the Holocaust. And then it took on an even greater urgency after the 1940s, when it was not only capturing a world which was being lost, but a world which was lost in a very tragic way. It's not nostalgic. On the contrary, if you read this book, sometimes it can rival Twain. Mark Twain's depiction as an adult of his childhood in a little town in Missouri, right, is riotously funny. It's satirical. He's also doing that. Ubatzedek, right? Not everything. It's a mistake we make. We think of 2,000 years of Eastern European history, right? And it's all we can think about is the gas chambers. Well, there were some other things going on throughout that history also. So in that sense, all of Kitvei Agnon is a type of Holocaust literature. It's a type of bringing his city back to life in a virtual reality, in a kind of sign, in a kind of siman for what once was in its fullness, Ir Umloa, a city and its fullness, the whole picture. So again, I'm happy to share with you some of, I'm happy to send you the Hebrew stories. And I think, as was mentioned, there's this series at the Beit Agnon, which is starting in 2 Sundays at 5:30 in the evening, 3 Sundays in a row, where we'll be reading some Agnon together, reading in English, making reference to the original Hebrew. Thank you.